like a word.
About backstory and book launches. You're listening to Weed Like a Word with me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Colgan.
And our guest this time is Tony Kent, author of Killer Intent, Marked for Death, and now Power Play. Welcome, Tony.
Hi, guys. Nice to be here.
So we're talking about book launches and backstory. Book launches first. We're doing this in a very unusual way. None of us are in the same town or in the same room. And we're doing it all remotely because of the prevailing coronavirus situation and keeping safe from each other. And this has meant your book launch for Power Play has been completely disrupted. So tell us about the book launch and then tell us about the book.
Well, the book launch was supposed to be on the 16th of April. The book is still coming out on the 16th of April when it's in paperback. It's already out in ebook. We are a little bit in limbo as to how we effectively launch a book in a country that's in complete and utter lockdown. So it's going to be an interesting experiment. I'm glad it's an experiment that my publishers are paying for rather than me, because I'm not completely confident it's going to be a successful experiment. Power Play is a book that was very, very relevant up until the COVID-19 crisis made everything else irrelevant. It's about an American president. It begins with a plane crash. The plane crash is caused by a bomb. Seems to be a terrorist attack, but there is some suspicion that, in fact, it may have some involvement with the White House. And the reason for that suspicion is because one of the people killed in the crash is a controversial but very successful potential presidential candidate. And so my ongoing characters from my series basically get involved in the investigation that follows. The investigation into the explosion is carried out by Joe Dempsey, who is my intelligence agent now working for the UN, and his part of the story is set mainly in the US. At the same time, Michael Devlin, who is my recurring criminal barrister character, is defending a Syrian refugee who is now a baggage handler who has admitted the act, at least, of putting the bomb on the plane. That's the setup for the book. It's all about, you know, effectively how much power can corrupt, who is really running the White House. And the tagline, I think, says it all, which is the enemies are not at the gate, they're already inside. The tagline we spent a long time trying to come up with. But as I say, the problem is that was very relevant in the era where Trump was dominating the world. But unfortunately, there's now a virus dominating the world. And God knows whether anyone's going to be able to lay their hands on this book, certainly in physical form, for a while to come.
So what is the plan for the alternative type of launch that you talked about?
Well, we're going very heavy into online advertising. We're very lucky that Tesco's not only made a very big order, they have also, of all the supermarkets, decided that books are an essential thing for life. That being so, they are still going to stock all of the books that they have bought from us. And since there's only about three shops in the country open, or three chains of stores open in the country, and Tesco's is one of them, we have been quite lucky in that respect, if people even think to buy books, which hopefully they will. Hopefully there will be some kind of a run on ebooks. But the key is getting the message out there, isn't it? The key is getting out there that this book exists. So we're running various competitions. There is a BookBub promotion. The ebook has gone down to 99p just to build up some sort of awareness. Unfortunately, the normal stuff, the advertising in the underground and things like that, well, that's no use because no one's on the underground. Well, actually, from the pictures we saw yesterday, probably too many people are on the underground. But yeah, the theory is that by the time April the 16th rolls around, that won't be the case anymore. So I'm going to have an online launch, which is something I've never done before. Facebook Live. I've set up a YouTube channel. I'm going to start a YouTube channel following the progress of my fourth book that I'm starting writing literally today. The fourth book is, for reasons that I'll come back to, is being written completely from scratch. Really have no idea what it's about. And I thought it might be interesting, when there's very little else to do, for people to follow the progress of that, of somebody sitting at a blank screen and just trying to come up with a book. So I've set up a YouTube channel starting today for that, which will hopefully, in its own way, build a bit of awareness, build some followers. And by April the 16th, maybe two or three people might tune in to the launch.
What's it called?
Just Tony Kent. I've not come up with anything better than that. I may change it to Tony Kent Writes, but it will be something along those lines.
It's interesting times for authors at the moment. I've heard a lot of authors saying that they're going to use this time to try and get the next book off the ground. Those that aren't juggling kids or trying to find food and everything else that we're doing. I mean, how are you coping with all of that?
As I've confessed on Twitter, Steve, I've actually had the virus. I got it quite early. I assume I must have caught it from going back and forward to various courts. I'm a criminal barrister as well as a writer. And the courts really are a bit of a throbbing petri dish for this sort of thing. And so about 3 weeks ago, well, actually it's not true, 2 weeks ago, yesterday, I woke up unable to breathe. Everything was spinning. Basically every single symptom that there was that you can get, I had. Because of the inability to breathe, they sent me an ambulance because they were worried it might be something more immediate, like a heart attack. The ambulance went through, did all the underlying tests, and the conclusion was, we're not allowed to test you for reasons I'll never understand, but you clearly have this. And so I was quarantined for 2 weeks. Those 2 weeks ended yesterday morning, literally, I think, 9 hours after the quarantine for the rest of us came in. So I'm 2 weeks further into this than most. Now I'm fully compos mentis, and now that I can focus a bit more, yeah, handling it is not easy. I don't think it's going to be easy for any of us for a while to come, but yeah, the alternative is far, far worse. And as I keep seeing jokes on Facebook and Twitter, we are really just being asked to stay indoors and not being asked to go and fight a war. So I think we've got to put it in perspective, really. And I think in perspective, it's very inconvenient. Economically, it's going to be disastrous. But ultimately, the alternative is we lose our grandparents and we lose our parents and we lose those of us who are younger but have underlying problems. And frankly, I think everyone's just got to get on with it.
And just for listeners, I should clarify that this is being recorded on the 25th of March because of some of the topical references that might mislead people. More generally, listener Anisha asks, you write books, this is your third one and you're starting your fourth one, you're a barrister, you have a family, what do you do in your spare time?
spare time is not something that I guess now I've got to get used to the idea that I've got some spare time, because even with all those things to do, there is some time there. I have a little boxing gym in what should be a garage. I ripped the garage out and turned it into a boxing gym because I used to box. And I'm hoping that that will become my spare time. I'm hoping that I will be able to use this opportunity to stop being quite the size I am and get down to a size closer to what I used to be. So the answer is, I don't have any. Ordinarily, I have no spare time. I think she summed it up very well by saying full-time barrister, writer, and then young family, which, you know, apart from sleeping, covered everything. But now that there is some spare time, I'm optimistic.
In the normal way of things, then, I was interpreting that more to mean, how on earth do you manage to fit in writing at all?
The first book wasn't difficult in terms of finding time because it took me years to write it. I just did it during, you know, train journeys and when juries were out deliberating and when I was waiting for a case to be called on. But, you know, when you have an unlimited, when you don't have a deadline, that's an easy thing to do. Second book, I'd written half of it before I got my contract. And so getting the other half of it was doable. The third book and the current book, I have a slightly unusual practice as a barrister. I used to work in a chambers called 2 Bedford Row, which any criminal barrister will tell you is basically the best, the leading criminal barrister's chambers in the country. I fluked in there when I was in my early 20s and somehow luckily managed to stay for 11 or 12 years. The problem with being in that particular place is you've got to be a team player and it's so incredibly busy. You will very rarely read on the front page of a newspaper about a case that does not involve that chambers. I mean, that's the level of chambers they are. They are the sort of Man United, Man City of the criminal bar. So I was lucky to be a part of that. But the problem is you have no free time. There is literally no free time. You're either working or you're on one of your very few holidays. And so it became impossible, really, it dawned on me, to fulfill this ambition, this driving ambition that I had to be a writer. It became an impossible ambition if I stayed there. And so a few years ago, I left. which people found utterly bizarre, because you don't leave Man City, and you certainly don't leave Man City to go and kick a ball against a wall down the road, which is effectively what I was doing. I got myself a little office and stuff by myself. And the whole idea was that I could then just take on the cases I wanted to take on and then have some free time, not be taking on other people's work, not be stepping in at the last minute to help with other cases, et cetera, et cetera. So the answer is, the only way I'm able to combine the two was by a massively risky fundamental life change that I made a few years ago. And if I hadn't done that, I don't think I could possibly be doing what I'm doing now.
Seems to be working out fairly well.
It does.
One of those risks that went right.
One of the things that struck me is you've got three main characters from the first book. So Joe Dempsey, who you mentioned, a military intelligence officer, Sarah Truman, a CNN reporter, and Michael Devlin, a Belfast-born criminal barrister with a secret past. And they end up working together over the different books. How do you manage to keep the three characters all interesting and all with enough heft over three and now four different books?
Well, I think you have to accept that you're going to focus certain books on certain ones. Killer Intent was very much 50-50 Joe Dempsey and Michael Devlin. Sarah Truman, at the risk of being in trouble, is very much an extension of Michael Devlin. She's a main character, but she's not the main character. So you have to kind of make a decision, I think. And with the first book, we introduced them both. It is very much 50-50 in terms of action between them, but it's also very much Michael's book. Joe Dempsey's doing his job, and you're getting to know him a bit, but you're getting to know him as the man who is doing his job. Yes, he's got a personal drive and motivation, but he's doing his job. Whereas Michael Devlin, you go back to his past, you meet his family, you find out all about it. So I think it's very much Michael's book, even though appearance-wise, 50-50. The second book is purely Michael. I mean, Joe Dempsey is features at the end of a phone line. And the only reason Joe Dempsey features at the end of a phone line is that if you are in trouble, as Michael was by the end of Mark for Death, and your mate happens to be a very well-connected, very resourceful, one of the toughest guys alive, you're not going to phone that guy, are you? I'll be completely honest with you. I got this idea all came for the fact that he phones Dempsey at all, Dempsey features at all in the second book. It actually comes because of Iron Man 3, weirdly enough. I remember sitting in the cinema in Notting Hill watching Iron Man 3 and saying to Victoria, my wife, who was very annoyed at the interruption, why is this guy not just phone the Hulk? He's got all this crap going on, and he's not phoned the Hulk or the God of Thunder. He's dealing with it himself. And it just occurred to me, Michael is going off to deal with something. He's going to phone his mate. So that book is fundamentally Michael Devlin. The third book is back to a much more of a two-man show. But at the same time, I feel it's Dempsey's Killer Intent. You learn a lot more about Dempsey. He's in it more than Michael, very, very much more Dempsey's Killer Intent. And as I say, I'm literally today about to start the fourth book. And all I know about the fourth book is it's a Dempsey story. And it may or may not feature Michael Devlin. I just don't know.
I suppose the progression was from local to international. So the first one, they even go to Belfast, and I was relieved that the Belfast bits were good because I'm from there too. I was thinking, oh no, I hope that isn't really lame. And it wasn't. Phew! And then it's around London, mainly in book two. And then all of a sudden you're on the world stage in book three in the White House in Afghanistan. This is your bid to be international best-selling writer. Is that strategic in that respect, or that's just the story that came to you?
It wasn't strategic in the sense of what of success internationally. I fully hope that that's the effect. But that wasn't intentional. What was intentional was, I, because of what I do for a living, because of the fact that I deal with very serious cases, and they're all very, very interesting individually, but ultimately, they're also all much the same. And I took the view that I couldn't keep writing London-based political legal thrillers. I wanted a bigger canvas, and I just thought the biggest canvas is, let's get Joe Dempsey and let's send him off to go and work for the UN, because if you send him off to work for the UN, he's working for the International Security Bureau. I've completely forgotten the ISB. I keep getting mixed up because it's IBS, International Security Bureau that he's working for in the UN. And the idea behind that was not so much, well, great, because now people in America will buy it. It was more, I can tell so many more stories with an international scope. I mean, I've got a whole bunch of ideas sort of lined up moving forward, one-liner concepts for various books, and they are all over the world. I mean, there's the preponderance of America in them, because, you know, it's just, that's just the natural way of telling these kinds of stories, but they are very international. You go to Africa, go to Asia, etc., etc.
Well, there you go. All very interesting. We'll take a break at this point, and when we come back, we'll talk about backstories.